today on Against the Grain. While inaction seems to be the order of the day, at some point, those in power may take serious measures against global warming, and the ecological and social effects of those measures may be alarming. What should the left advocate and struggle for? I'm Sasha Lilly. I'll speak with environmental historian Troy Vitese about the idea of rewilding half the earth by replacing pasture land with forests and wilderness. From the studios of KPFA in Berkeley, California, this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly. It's become very clear that massive-scale economic and social change is needed immediately to forestall the more perilous effects of global heating. Yet those changes have serious implications for the future in the ways they will remake the world ecologically and socially. Troy Vitese, in an essay titled To Freeze the Thames, Natural Geoengineering and Biodiversity, makes the case for returning half the world to wild nature. He's a postdoctoral fellow at Harvard University's Weatherhead Center, and he joins me now. Troy, I wanted to ask you about some of the many ideas being advocated for addressing the climate emergency before we get to your arguments about rewilding half the earth. I'd like to start with artificial geoengineering. That's the idea of putting iron filings into the ocean to absorb carbon or spraying aerosol chemicals up into the sky to block the sun's rays and cool the planet. What do you make of these proposals, and how likely do you think it is that they're going to be seriously considered in the future?
Well, first I would say that there actually is a left position for geoengineering, artificial geoengineering. I mean, I just read a book by Holly Jean Buck.
And I should say we had Holly Jean Buck on Against the Grain to talk about one aspect of geoengineering, and listeners can find that interview on againstthegrain.org.
Yeah, so she's, I know, one person who favors at least thinking through what it would mean to have a left position on geoengineering. You know, there's the whole crowd at Jacobin, like Peter Fraze and whatnot, who also are in favor of it. So, I mean, it's not like an inherently an anti-left position to be in favor of it. I'm personally not in favor of it, but I mean, I think we should be clear about that. I think we should also be clear about how it's actually going to happen, because I think it will happen. And the strategy, my guess, is that it's going to be, well, they'll say, well, the Great Barrier Reef is about to die, so we have to like cool the atmosphere just above it to prevent it from deteriorating. So it'll be like a small-scale geoengineering effort. Or they'll say, like, the one of the ice sheets in Antarctica is going to fall off unless we cool that area down, and therefore we have to do some major drastic steps. And a lot of people will say, well, we have to do it, as in we have no choice, right? And then from there, it becomes acceptable and so forth. So that's my guess how it's going to happen. People already are talking like that. In terms of like what I think of it, this is exactly what the right wants. I mean, Philip Murawski, whom I draw on quite a bit, he writes in his last book, I Never Let a Serious Crisis Go to Waste, that in the short term it's going to be denial, denial, denial of climate change. The medium term is going to be cap and trade, but they're not going to work. They're going to set the cap too high and all that. And then eventually they're going to buy time, they buy decades doing this until geoengineering is ready. And then at that point, it'll be in such a bad state that people will say, okay, that's what we have to do. And then things will go on as before. So it's, I think that's the script, right? And that's kind of what's happening. There's lots of reasons to be against geoengineering. It's just very dangerous. Even the geoengineers themselves compare it to nuclear weapons. No one's going to know what's going to happen until you actually do it. You can't really experiment. And there's no situation where the whole world is better off. Like some place is going to be worse off. And some weird things could happen, whether it's the monsoon cycle is broken or the Gulf Stream, as in like very serious consequences could result. So we should be against it, but I think people aren't talking about it enough and they're not critical enough.
And there's another proposal which does not originate on the left, but is supported by some people who would identify either with the left, like George Monbiot, or with the environmental movement, like James Hansen, who are proposing that, kind of what you were saying with artificial geoengineering, that desperate times call for desperate measures, and that nuclear power is something that should be very seriously considered, and that nuclear power plants should be built at a rapid pace from here on out.
Yeah, I mean, I also disagree with this. And there's a reason why they support this, right? It's because they realize renewables entail a significant cost, which would be land use mainly, but also like, you know, they're variable and so forth. It's going to be hard to make an entirely renewable system. So you have to balance it out with something else, right? Which would be nuclear. If you're an environmentalist, let's say, if we want to go carbon neutral. The problem with nuclear is that, you know, a lot of these guys like Hansen and all that, they're in favor of these fast breeder reactors, which is a technology that just has been around for ages. I believe like the first reactor actually created was a fast breeder. But regardless, it's not a new technology. People know what they're like, and they just don't work very well because, sure, the end product is a nuclear source that you actually can reuse, as it doesn't actually create toxic, you know, like nuclear waste, as normal reactions do. But the thing is, it's just incredibly unstable because any kind of leak, like air leak, will set the thing on fire, right? Because it's using this coolant that is liquid sodium. So they're always on fire, basically. Like they spend 90% of the time down for repairs. So they just don't work, right? No one makes them unless they want to make lots of plutonium for weapons, right? That's the only purpose for them. So, but they don't say that. They just say, oh, this is a great technology that has a limitless fuel supply. It creates its own fuel. So it's completely bonkers, I think. And the other thing would be, even if you use like small scale reactors, like the Economist is in love with these mini reactors you can put on barges and all that. I mean, all this stuff ignores the fact that nuclear has a very bad safety record, let alone the big catastrophes, which are very bad. And people, I think, don't really realize how dangerous they are. And people say, well, no one actually died from Fukushima directly from the radiation and whatnot, or very few people died from Chernobyl, just like 50 people died. That's ignoring the radiation deaths. And people estimate between like 9,000 to 90,000 people died in Chernobyl. Around 3,000 probably will die as a result of Fukushima. So these are very dangerous technologies. And the odds of having another serious mass disaster is like 1 in 2 in the next 4 decades, right? That's one estimate. But if you increase the number of reactors from, say, 440, whatever we have now, to, let's say, 5 or 6 times that number, which is what Monbiot and co propose, you're just going to have lots of disasters. I mean, that's going to be the result. So I think that's just, let alone the cost and everything else. Like, it's just crazy to imagine nuclear is going to play a role.
Well, another proposal that is not a new one appeared in the 1970s and is associated with Herman Daly, and that's the idea of a no-growth or steady-state economy. So rather than just a technological fix, this entails some kind of broader societal change, but it takes place within the confines of capitalism. Tell us more about that idea and why you don't think it's viable.
Well, it's funny because people think I am a degrowther, right? And when I wrote my article, then I think there was a response to it. I got paired with the degrowth crowd. And I think at some level, you know, ecological economics is interesting and, you know, contributes something to the debate. But, and I personally went through a phase of being interested in ecological economics during my own intellectual trajectory. But I never felt it very rigorous. I mean, this idea of, like, you know, how much degrowth, right? Or where does growth come from? They always talk about growth as a belief or like an ideology or something like that. And that just mistakes the kind of society we live in, which is a capitalist society, where whether or not you like growth, you're not going to last as a capitalist unless you create a profitable enterprise and at the going rate of profit. And if you're not doing that, then you're going to get eaten up, right? So there's a structural reason why growth occurs and why capitalism is especially conducive to growth. And they just ignore all that. So I think this is why I'm a Marxist, right? This is why I think that's a much more helpful framework to understand why growth is a problem and where growth comes from. And therefore, this idea that we can just, you know, convince everyone to give up growth and still have a capitalist framework and at a steady state just doesn't make any sense. Because if you're not making the rate of profit, you're going to lose as a capitalist.
Well, more recently, We've heard a lot about a Green New Deal, and of course there are many ways that that proposal could be fleshed out, but basically it presumes a massive transition to renewable energy. And I wanted to ask you what your take is on a Green New Deal that was based on renewable energy as a sufficient response to the climate emergency.
I'm also happy that people are using this language. I remember in 2008, people were initially talking about a Green New Deal, because as in, you know, we have to have a Keynesian response to the Great Recession, and may as well spend on renewables, and nothing came much of it, actually, right? And then now it's really gained some traction, and something might result. And that's good to see. I think generally, the environmentalists on the left who support the Green New Deal, they don't want to really push people too hard, right? So they want to say, well, if you fix electricity, and you know, we're going to do a lot better, right? And that's, electricity is only about a fifth of all energy consumption, and that's not very much, right? So even if we do have a 100% renewable energy system, electrical system, like, we're still ignoring transportation, we're ignoring agriculture, we're ignoring heating and all this kind of stuff. So as in, it's going to be a harder shift than just that. And I think it also requires telling people, you know, you probably have to give up more than you would like, right? But no one wants to actually say that, because you're afraid of scaring off supporters. If you say, like, probably you can't fly very often, if at all, right? Or you really, you know, as in, land use is important, and we have to reforest as much as we can, therefore you can't have as many hamburgers or whatever it is. I mean, that's those are more difficult discussions. And you see a little bit of that. People say you should eat a little less meat, like AOC said that or something. But I think it's not being structured into any kind of response of what needs to be done, right? I think people also underestimate the land use requirements for renewable energy.
Tell us about that. You write about the difference in terms of power density of fossil fuels and renewable energy.
So I rely quite a bit on this energy scholar named Vaclav Smil, and he writes about power density. And power density is this metric of how many watts do you need, or it is produced per square meter, right? That's the relationship, watts per square meter. And for fossil fuels, they're just, like, so energy dense, and, you know, they're often underground, and therefore the mine shaft is, you know, smaller, as you just have an oil derrick just on top or whatever it is. So the actual footprint isn't very large, but then you have, like, a massive amount of energy coming out. So the power density for fossil fuels can be as much as, like, 10,000 watts per square meter, right? Or even, like, the worst kind, which would be, like, mountaintop removals in, like, the several hundreds. And also just, like, a bad one, like the tar sands in Canada, which is really, like, bottom of the barrel, you know, just garbage in terms of fossil fuels, right? It's not even petroleum, it's just tar, right? Even that has a power density of 1,000 watts per square meter. But the best you're going to get from renewables is several orders of magnitude less than that. So it's not going to be much higher than 10, maybe 15 watts per square meter for, like, the best systems. That's like solar concentration, systems, like these pylon systems, or and it could be much worse. Like, if you have a solar power system in Germany where it's pretty cloudy, it might be just like 2 or 4 watts per square meter, right? If you have biofuels, it's less than 1. And that means you need a huge amount of space. So if the current energy system in the United States, which is a mix of nuclear and fossil fuels and some renewables and all that, if that footprint for that is around 1% of the whole territory, right, for that system, it would be around 20% or 50% of total land in the United States if it were 100% renewable, depending if you use biofuels or not, right? So as in massive, massive land use requirements for renewables. And that's, like, an ultimate constraint. I mean, if you're in, like, Japan or Germany, I mean, your whole country would be covered in wind turbines and solar panels, and then you can't grow anymore, as in you can't use any more energy. Where does it go? And people talk about using the ocean and putting these kind of platforms in the sea, or they're talking about having something like Desert Tech, where you fill up the Sahara with solar panels, and then you ship that to to Europe. But I mean, that's just, I think, just kind of crazy and imperialistic and not a real solution. But my point is, like, this is like a real constraint.
Environmental historian Troy Vitese is my guest. You're listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio, and I'm Sasha Lilly. Well, what you've just described about the power density of fossil fuels versus renewables gets to the heart of the argument that you make, which is that you argue that we should be thinking centrally about land and land scarcity being a fundamental part of how to handle the climate emergency. Tell us why land has actually been not really the focus of mainstream economics, and why you think that land is going to be so essential in considerations of how to deal with the climate crisis.
Well, if you look at classical economy, I mean, they're focused on land use. And if you think about the problems of like the biological old regime, as in like society before fossil fuels, they always had to make a decision between, are they going to use land for fiber? Are they going to use it for food or for fuel, right? And they always had to be a trade-off. So there's always like this, you're trying to get the most out of your land system at the margin. And you're debating whether you want to bring marginal land in or not. And that's like really where economics comes from, right? And then people would assume as soon as you get the best ratio of these three things, then and you're making the best use of land, then eventually there can't be any more growth, as in you would hit some kind of limit of what the land could produce, and then it would be a steady state, right? So this is like Mill, I think Ricardo also talks about it, but Mill definitely, and Smith as well. So that's kind of how they saw economics, right? And then that, and even when that era ends with the use of coal growing rapidly in the 1830s, even when you have a shift to a fossil fuel economy, the people still think, you know, this can't last, right? Think this has to be scarce. And what are we going to do after we run out of coal? Because then we're not going to grow anymore, right? And then, so you don't really have this kind of idea of like limitless growth until petroleum really starts replacing coal in lots of areas in the 1930s. And Tim Mitchell makes the argument that's really Keynes that starts to imagine this idea of economy that's separate from its material base. So it's quite late when we start thinking that the economic world and the natural world are right, separate, and therefore we can have endless growth. And it's predicated on the shift from different energy regimes.
Why do you think land is going to be so central, or is so central, in dealing with the climate crisis?
So the idea is, if you don't want to use fossil fuels, then suddenly land comes back in. Because basically before, you're working with energy flows, right? As in whether it's water power, or wind power, or you know, say trees, or you know the or crops. That's just energy coming from the sun and flowing through and passing through, right? And we're trying to capture that and use that, right? And then with fossil fuels, that's really representing a use of stock, as in this is ancient sunlight that's been buried for millions of years, and we're digging that up and using that energy. So it's not, we don't face the constraint of how much energy can we use at this minute, because we're trying to capture a flow and there's only so much power going through. If you think about what, in terms of power density, the amount of solar power hitting the earth at any one point is around 180 watts on average per square meter. So as in you can't really get beyond that, right? But suddenly if you have access to fossil fuels, you have just like endless amounts of energy that you can draw upon, right? As in millions and millions of years of old solar energy. But if we're not going, and that's why there's no, that's why you don't have to worry about land constraints anymore in terms of a fossil powered regime. But if you're going to say we don't want any more fossil fuels, then you're returning back to flow, right? And if you're returning back to flow, then you're facing the constraints that these classical economists were facing 200 years ago. So it's kind of like this return of what economics used to be. That's one reason, and there's no real way to get beyond that, I would say. I wrote the essay because I thought as I was reading a bunch of random things, and I saw that land constraints were prevalent everywhere, right? And that unified various problems that were discussed separately. So we have, again, renewable energy. If renewable energy is going to require lots of land, we were saying with like a whole country must be covered in renewable turbines if you're in Germany, or half in the United States. I mean, that's something you have to think about, right? But if you also, you're thinking about how do we stop the sixth extinction, and people, I think, aren't aware to the proper extent of what the cause of mass extinctions are. It's really land use change. I mean, climate change matters, but even right now, climate change is pretty minor in terms of making species go extinct. It's really tearing up habitats and transforming habitats, and often for farms, right? And therefore, if you want to prevent the sixth extinction, we have to set aside more land for nature, right? And there's this naturalist, E.O. Wilson, he makes an argument for having half of the world be preserved, right, to prevent the sixth extinctions. But if you want half the world, suddenly you have to think about land constraints, right? And that would contradict with your goal of having renewable energy, right? And then the last thing would be, if we want to have natural geoengineering, which would be to reforest as much as we can to actually take in more carbon to actually cool the earth, we also need huge amounts of land, and like on the order of 1 or 2 billion hectares, which is the size of Canada. Or I mean, like 1 billion hectares, the size of Canada, so two Canadas, right? Is kind of what you need if you really want to lower the amount of carbon in the atmosphere. But suddenly you see, well, all these goals require huge amounts of land, right? And that's probably the most important impediment for achieving any of them. So. And people, I think, would generally say we want to achieve those things. So the question is, how do we actually achieve that? And other problems, other ways to think about these problems just aren't as relevant in a way. It's not about cost. It's really about how much land do we have.
So, and when we're talking about all the land that's going to be necessary, if this proposal, this idea of slowing the climate crisis by rewilding, give us a sense of the scale of that. What would that look like in a place like the United States?
Half of the country would be rewilded, as that would be the goal. And right now, generally, it's only about 15% of the world, of the terrestrial landmass, has any kind of protection, right? As in like a national park. And usually you can still, you know, cut down trees and mine even in national parks. Like, I'm Canadian. That's, you see that in Canada all the time. So even then, they're not very well protected. That's still only 15%. So if you want to increase that to 50%, I mean, that's going to be quite serious, right?
And are you talking about farmland? Are you talking about places that are suburban or urbanized?
The amount of land that we have that's like not mountainous or, you know, desert is around 10 billion hectares, right? And around half of that would be used for some form of agriculture. So it's 5 billion hectares. And of that 5, 3.5 is used for pasture, and 1.5 is used for various kinds of crops. So if you, like dairy or meat, you probably are relying on that pasture, right? So pasture use is, or pasture land is the largest single use of land in the world. And basically, if you want to do anything, if you want to have more space for renewable energy systems, if you want to have more space for rewilding, and most of that pasture land used to be forested, at least half, then you have to deal with meat consumption. You have to actually lower meat consumption to rewild that pasture. That's basically the argument that I make in the piece. And I'm not alone in this. If you read the IPCC reports, they're all constantly talking about land, and they're all constantly talking about meat consumption.
And this is the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change.
Yes. Because they don't really like geoengineering either, right? And they're skeptical of other solutions, such as a carbon capture and storage and all that. So they're quite keen on rewilding as a solution, but they're also aware that it has to come from pasture. But then again, you tell people you can't eat 100 kilograms of meat anymore every year, then people are going to get upset. compared to everything else you need to do, such as remaking cities, I mean, getting rid of capitalism, figuring out transportation and all that. Those are all huge, big problems. And some things it seems like we can't solve. I mean, there's no renewable way to fly, or there's no sustainable way or non-fossil fuel powered way to make cement or steel, right? And these things are much more intractable problems. So, but the idea of, but we can change our diet tomorrow, right? Or, what are we actually going to eat next year depends on what we plant in the autumn, right? I mean, so those are, if anything, that's like the easy solution. And the agricultural industry, although it's quite large, is a dwarf compared to the fossil fuel industry or the car industry. I mean, it's only a couple of percentile of world GDP, right? Like, this is not the hard part. This is the easy part. Mm-hmm.
I should say that I'm speaking with environmental historian Troy Vitese about his extended essay, To Freeze the Thames, Natural Geoengineering and Biodiversity, which was published in New Left Review. He's postdoctoral fellow at Harvard's Weatherhead Center. So let me ask you more about this idea of rewilding half the earth. And I have to ask you, do you think the originator of this idea of the half earth, E.O. Wilson, should give us some pause in considering this natural geoengineering idea, which is that E.O. Wilson has a very problematic political history, both as a supporter of genetic determinism and if I'm not mistaken, also supporting conservation that forced indigenous peoples off their land in places like South America. How do you sort of square that with this larger idea of rewilding half the earth?
And he's definitely a controversial figure, and I agree with you there. I still would agree with his analysis that land use change and fragmentation of ecosystems is the major cause of extinction. And he's like the first expert to really work on that in the 1950s. And he's been proven right by that. He's not really uncontroversial in that respect. So I think you can try to separate the man from the idea. In terms of the rest of it, whether what one should do with indigenous people living in forests and all that, like, I'm all in favor of that. I'm personally against removing indigenous people, just to be clear about that. So I'm not too bothered by drawing on his ideas there. I would say, it's, one could always use ideas by people that you don't like. I mean, Carl Schmitt is a very popular theorist right now in the academy, and he's not a very nice guy.
Indeed.
So I think, I don't think that in itself should be a reason to oppose him. He, I should stress, is only interested in stopping the sixth extinction, right? With that idea of the half earth. I'm the one that really said, we have to think about renewables, we have to think about natural geoengineering as well. And I was drawn to his idea about improving biodiversity, because biodiverse ecosystems are better at sequestering carbon, right? So if you just have a bunch of tree plantations, you're not going to sequester very much carbon. But if you have an ecosystem with lots of trophic levels, as in like predator-prey relationships and a very diverse set of animals and plants, you're going to be sequestering more. And we've seen that in action. We've seen that happen. So I think that's why I want to tie these ideas together.
Let me ask you about examples of rewilding in the past. Remind us what the Little Ice Age was of the 16th to 19th centuries and what took place during that time in terms of reforestation.
So this is one theory, and I think it's not totally uncontested, but I find it the most convincing, and it's definitely has a lot of supporters within the scientific community. And that the idea is that the decrease in temperature, which is about a bit more than half a degree in the northern hemisphere, which caused Europe and Eurasia to be much cooler than before, and especially rainier than before, and would cause the freezing of riverways and whatnot that didn't really happen before, such as the Thames. So the Thames didn't freeze very often, maybe like once a century or something like that. And then all of a sudden, it started freezing once every 10 years or so, which is why they had frost fairs, right? And if anyone's read Orlando, you know that Orlando meets Sasha at a frost fair in London in this period. So it was that cold to actually freeze the Thames, and the Thames hasn't frozen in London, I think, for almost 200 years now. So it's definitely, that period's over. What caused this little ice age, people think, is actually the depopulation of the Americas after first contact, and also West Africa. So actually taking out like 12 million people from West Africa, depopulated West Africa as well, which is also quite crucial, which wasn't in my essay. And that by depopulating these areas, and I should really mention that in the Americas, people don't know how many people lived in the Americas in 1492, but the estimates vary between 50 to 100 million people. And then all of a sudden you go down to about 5 million people, right, through epidemics and enslavement and genocide. So all this huge amount of land becomes forested and it sequesters a huge amount of carbon, right? And that probably is why the earth got colder for a little bit. And it's only when the population rebounded, especially in the Americas by the 19th century, that you have the end of the Little Ice Age, because you know they're cutting down these forests and building farms and all that. So that's the theory. And I mentioned that in the essay because I want people to think big in a way, right? I want people to think, well, how, you know, can we actually change the climate quickly through natural geoengineering, right? Through reforestation. And what would it look like to do this in a bloodless, democratic way, right?
Indeed, because it's a horrible moment in history which had ecological consequences that we can look back on, but was to do with a mass depopulation through, as you say, genocide and infectious diseases and so on. But at least being aware that such a thing has happened historically, if rewilding were politically possible now, how quick would it take effect in terms of being able to draw in enough carbon to have a significant effect on the pace of global heating?
I just want to mention real quick that environmentalists tend to be Marxist or Malthusians, right?
Sure.
As in capitalism is the problem or population is the problem. And I'm definitely a Marxist, right? And I never espouse anything in terms of, oh, there's too many people and all that. So I think whenever an environmentalist says that, and many environmentalists do think that, that's always a bad sign, right? So
indeed.
Just to be clear, in terms of how quick this can actually happen, well, there's been periods where you can see reforestation happen. Like one little natural experiment occurred in the Soviet Union. When the Soviet Union collapsed, a lot of forests regrew in Russia because the state forestry companies had disappeared, right? And then no one was cutting down these trees for a little bit. And that actually was a pretty massive regrowth, right? The Chinese government has a very successful reforestation program, believe it or not. And they've also seen dramatic changes, especially in more biodiverse wild forests since the 1970s. So within like a decade or two, you can actually see a difference. And when you combine that with what's going on with animals, I mean, you can already see that with Yosemite, right, where they reintroduced the wolves. I mean, they hadn't been there in 100 years, whatever it was. And the wolves come back in and they prevent deer from feeding on saplings by rivers and all that, because rivers have a clear line of sight and therefore are very dangerous for deer. And therefore all these trees regrew in certain parts of the park, and that helped with erosion and all that, but it also just increased the forest cover. And you can see the same thing happening with return of otter to kelp forests in BC. So my point is this can happen relatively quickly. To give you exact numbers, we have to work on modeling. And again, that's what I'm going to be doing over the next few months or so, is to try to figure that out. And it also depends on what ecosystems you are rewilding. I mean, some of them, like redwood forests, they can sequester, like something like 2,000 tons of carbon per hectare, it's something enormous, right? While other forests are in the hundreds. Tropical forests regrow quite quickly, Well, obviously, a redwood forest takes much longer. So it depends what you're rewilding, right? One could also counter that, okay, let's say we start doing this tomorrow, but what if, you know, the rest of the world's not, is like still emitting emissions and we still have climate change going on, then these ecosystems will no longer be viable. Like, what if the Amazon turns into a savanna, right? Which could happen. And which is a very serious point of critique. And I would say, well, you kind of have to make do everything at once, basically, as in like stop emitting carbon emissions and to rewild as quickly and extensively as possible.
Environmental historian Troy Vitese is my guest. I'm Sasha Lilly, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. Well, are there limits to the amount of carbon that forests, rewilded areas, could absorb? At a certain point, would the amount of carbon that was being taken out of the atmosphere slow down?
Well, if you do it at scale, it would definitely be sufficient. I mean, people talk about if there was only, you know, 1 billion hectares reforested, like one of that 3.5 we have to play around with if we get rid of the livestock industry, then that would probably bring us back down to like the low 300s in terms of carbon parts per million, right? And right now it's like, what, 410? So that's a pretty significant decrease. And if we stopped emitting, that probably would make us safe. That probably would be enough. And if you sequester more, I'd say 2 billion hectares, you know, then you're definitely laughing. There's some disagreement among scientists whether like how quickly you reach a saturation point. Some people think that it becomes saturated, then like a mature forest will not sequester any more carbon, and therefore it's useless, more or less, from the point of view of people who want to increase sequestration. And therefore, that's why BECCS are very popular amongst the IPCC, which is bioenergy and carbon capture and sequestration, which is you have a forest, cut it down, burn it for energy, and then you sequester it as you capture the carbon before it goes into the atmosphere, and you send it, you know, through a pipeline and down and, you know, somewhere deep underground, right? And then you grow another forest and you do that again, so you can sequester that carbon, right? So it's one thing that's quite prominent in the last IPCC report. The thing is, there are also a lot of scientists who say that this argument about saturation is wrong, and actually mature forests continue to sequester fair amounts of carbon because much of a tree is underground, right? And it will be, you know, accumulating and decomposing and accumulating more.
Let me ask you more about something that you touched on earlier, which is the politically volatile question of limiting consumption. And you mentioned veganism, taking pasture land away from animal agriculture and rewilding that land. And that obviously requires that people change their food consumption patterns. But you also argue that other changes are necessary in order to head off the climate crisis. And you even use the term eco-austerity. Now, austerity obviously is not a popular thing on the left, forced upon people in times of crisis to make those at the bottom pay for the crises of capitalism. How do you understand eco-austerity in this picture, and where does class come into that question?
I would say just in like the broader kind of span of environmental debates, you have to think back to like the 1980s, when there's this whole thing between Julian Simon and Paul Ehrlich, right? And Julian Simon was this neoliberal thinker, and he was saying, you know, there's no such thing as scarcity because what we care about is not the thing that's scarce, but the service, right? So I can give an example of well, there's maybe no more fish in the ocean, but we have aquaculture. So we have, and like fish flesh is the service that we care about, not the fish itself. And if fish meat is cheap, then there's no scarcity. So that was his argument, right? And then you have Ehrlich, and he's saying there are real limits, and those limits are going to cause the system to crash, right? So therefore, we have to, you know, change society.
And this, of course, is the Malthusian author of The Population Bomb.
Yes. And at some level, both of them are right, right? As in, they even were debating about fish populations. And, there actually is a downward trend, and most fish stocks have collapsed. So Ehrlich's right about that, as in there is like a limit of how much you can take. But then Simon's also right where, you can just destroy like a resource, but as long as you can create another resource, then from the point of view of the market, nothing's really been lost. My point is, you can't expect scarcity itself to cause a certain politics to emerge, right? If we're waiting for, like running out of petroleum or something like that, and we actually have really reached a peak amount of conventional petroleum we can extract, when it was actually predicted by Hubbert in like the early 2000s, that actually was true, right? But then you go on to non-conventionals like the tar sands, and that maybe raises the price for a bit and all that. But as long that the system is still functioning, even though that resource has run out, right? So I think like the neoliberal answer to that is quite a subtle response, and it's a response that actually has won that debate. Right. So my point is, again, we can't expect scarcity to do the political work for us. We have to say ourselves, we're going to only take this much, right? We're not going to have be forced to reduce our consumption. We have to decide to reduce our consumption, and that's a harder thing to do. In terms of, what is a fair way to do that? I did use the term eco-austerity in my essay, but I also did stress that the poorest people of the world have to be allowed to double their consumption. And I was drawing on the framework of the 2000 Watt Society, which is from a technical university in Zurich. And that argument is, if a person, say a European uses around 6,000 watts, more or less continuously, an American uses like 12,000 watts, and an Indian uses 1,000. Therefore, the Indian should be allowed to double and have 2,000 watts, right? But then everyone else has to go back down to 2,000, right? To really reduce your consumption. And what does that actually look like? It looks like, you're not going to eat meat, you're not going to have your own car, you're going to live in a passive house. I mean, there's lots of ways to cut consumption. I would not say, there's no like hair shirt, austerity and brutality. This is going to be a life that's definitely livable and enjoyable and have lots of benefits. I mean, if you want to have free education or health care and all that, that should be part of that. But you can't expect to just have a Tesla or something like that, or have a giant house in the suburbs, but you recycle. I mean, that's not good enough, right? It has to be much more serious transformation than that.
Sure, and you were talking about the wealth disparities between the global north and south, which of course are intense, but even in a place like the United States, in the global north, some people consume a whole lot more than others. How do you think around those questions of austerity in the wealthy countries?
Well, I mean, you would do things such as you try to get rid of private car ownership relatively quickly. You would do it in a way of having caps on, I guess housing units and all that, and try to get rid of single detached homes in the long term, right? Do you want to change suburbs so that they're concentrated rather than so sprawling? I mean, you have to do it in certain ways to really reduce consumption. You have to, I mean, a friend of mine, like Andreas Malm, he was talking about this need for like eco-Leninism, right? And saying, banning domestic flights, no more domestic flights and all that, or veganism and all that. And some of these things can be done through planning and through legislation. And the IPCC actually does stress that as well. I mean, one thing that struck me reading the IPCC's reports is that to a degree they're more radical than the left on a lot of these issues, right? I mean, they're saying we have to use the power of the state to get people to consume less. And you don't hear that often enough from the left.
That may partly be because the history of state-directed policies on the left, has been a problematic history, to say the least. But let's talk about one particular case where a transition was made to a more ecologically sustainable society with much more forested land, and that's Cuba. Now, Cuba is complicated because the Cuban state is also repressive in its way, but also had the mechanism to direct the kind of changes that the country was forced to make after the disintegration of the Soviet Union in the 1990s. And the Soviet Union had subsidized the Cuban economy through petroleum and other inputs. And when that went away, the society contracted, and it was a very painful period of time for Cubans. But tell us about what came out of that period.
I first want to mention that thinking about energy futures, right? I mentioned the 2000 watt society, and that's kind of as a way to think about, well, what does a Swiss yuppie eco life look like? That's like one path in a way. And then another way to kind of think about the same problem is through the special period of the 1990s in Cuba, as in, what does it look like for society to have no fossil fuels all of a sudden, right? And what can the, and what, especially when that's a leftist, you know, communist society, what happens? And what's interesting about the Cuban case is to what degree it shows the interrelation between all the other factors that we were talking about, such as land use and energy and agriculture and biodiversity, right? These things are all connected, and you saw that through the Cuban case. So they suddenly didn't have any petroleum, and Cuban agriculture was extremely industrialized. They were actually using more fertilizer per hectare than American farmers were, right? And it's not like, and I think we kind of imagine Cuba as this bucolic place, but you know, in the 1980s, it was, you know, heavily industrialized. And then all of a sudden, they don't have any petroleum, and they can't afford it, right? So they had organic agriculture, they kind of got rid of the distinction between the city and the country, and they had, you know, farms in cities, and they tried to encourage people to go back to the countryside, but to have universities and healthcare as well in the country. They had to give up a lot of land simply because they couldn't run their tractors. So they had to farm less extensively and more intensively, which meant that there's more land that nature could recover. And Cuba's a biodiversity hotspot. You know, they have the best intact reefs. They have a huge amount of forest cover. I think it was the WWF said in the 2000s that they were the only sustainable country in the world, right? So they actually managed to achieve a lot. People had to ride their bikes. The Cuban government bought 1 million bikes from China, right? People didn't have petrol to run their cars. So all these things came together, and people had to eat less meat as well. Right. So all these things came together because there was no petroleum, and they managed to keep education and health up during the crisis. Right. Although I'm not trying to say that it was like a fun time. People, if you talk to any Cubans, they'll tell you that it was hard. It was extremely hard. And they were undergoing, you know, tightened sanctions during all this as well.
Sure. And it was, but they managed, that malnutrition went up amongst Cubans.
Yes. They had. There was an epidemic of eye disease because by malnutrition, and the government actually managed to spot it and respond quite quickly to deal with it. And that was probably the worst thing that happened. But still, having a strong government that's able to plan for these things made a significant difference and let them get through this more or less intact, right? If anything, with actual better health outcomes. I think the infant mortality rate continued to decline and life expectancy continued to rise despite the hardship, which tells you how effective the Cuban state is.
Right. And of course, it's a difficult example to copy in that whatever the failings of the Cuban state, the egalitarian structure of that society before the crisis made it much more likely that through a crisis that health and well-being would be maintained. And of course, we find ourselves in a highly unequal world, you know, most of the world under neoliberalism, and it makes for a much more perilous struggle into the future. I know that your essay focused on and this possible direction of rewilding without grappling with the politics of what's possible, what's not. But I wanted to end by asking you if you had any thoughts on how it might be possible to convince people to support something that requires such a change to the ways people's lives have been so far, the ways that cities and the countryside looks, and how that might be possible, on kind of what sort of basis you could see such a political, social, economic, ecological change being popular enough to get support.
Well, I'll say real quick about Cuba. But definitely it was difficult. But the point was, this is what happens when it's totally unplanned, when it's a total catastrophe, when it's just, right? And you should think about what it would look like in a rich society that where it is planned, just to be clear about that. And I guess it kind of gets into the other question, would be like, what do we want? If you don't have markets and you're skeptical of capitalism, you have to have planning. What does democracy look like under planning? And the left hasn't really done a very good job, I think, articulating or dealing with that problem, right? Mm-hmm. And that leads us to, I guess, your question about how do you actually build support for this idea of like half-earth economics, right? Like, what would that actually look like? I suppose the point of the essay was to kind of give a few pieces, a few building blocks for people to think through problems, right? So, and based on the land problem. So I would say, well, if you want to achieve these three goals of natural geoengineering, 100% renewables, and stopping the sixth extinction, right, then you can only do so many things. And if you have the land, as in you have to give up meat and you have to lower consumption and all this kind of stuff. But if you don't want to do that, then you have to do artificial geoengineering, or you have to have nuclear, right, or something like that. So the point was, it's a matter of choice, right? And the way we're going right now is we're going to have non-conventional fossil fuels, we're going to have geoengineering, and that's the way we're going. And my guess is we're going to start to have geoengineering at a very serious level within 10 years, right? As in, we don't have that much time to make that choice. And part of the reason for writing that essay was a frustration with the left and with environmentalists who say, oh, this is win-win. You know, like, we can have green growth and all that. You can have everything you want, but just have it, you know, powered by renewable energy or whatever. It was a green version of this or whatever. It was a frustration with that, the state of that debate. And I think no matter how you make that choice, at least I want you to think about you're making a hard choice. There's always going to be a hard choice. And you always have to give up something, whether you're going to accept the extinction of half of the world's plants and animals, or whatever, right? I want you to make that choice. And I would think that given that that contrast, there would be a lot of people to say, well, I don't want the sky bleached because we blocked out, you know, the atmosphere to reflect the sun's rays and we don't have any more sunshine anymore, right? Like, I don't want to live in a world like that. Or I don't want to live in a world where it's just meat, a bunch of cows and cockroaches or something like that. As in, I want people to kind of think that way and think, well, what do I have to do to actually get what I want? And start having those conversations. And then hopefully some people would be won over to whatever I'm proposing.
Troy Vitese, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you.
Troy Vitese is an environmental historian. He's a postdoctoral fellow at Harvard University's Weatherhead Center. And he's the author of the essay, To Freeze the Thames, Natural Geoengineering and Biodiversity. And you can find a link to that essay on againstthegrain.org. You've been listening to Against the Grain. I'm Sasha Lilly. Thanks so much for listening. And please tune in again next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. Please visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio and a way to sign up for our podcast. And you can check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio or follow us on Twitter at Radio Against.